24 of the Westminster Confession, which deals with marriage and divorce, might begin by mentioning the fact that, as far as I am aware, only the Westminster Confession of Faith, among all the Reformed confessions, has a chapter on this important subject. The other great creeds, like the ones you may be familiar with in the back of the Psalter Hymnal of the Christian Reformed Church, they deal with other matters, but not with marriage and divorce. And yet here is one of the basic institutions of mankind, certainly as important as the state, maybe even more so. And I'm thankful for the fact that our confession contains this. Of course, the historic Baptist confession and congregational confession, which are based on the Westminster, do also contain this chapter. Let us read then from this chapter the first three sections. Marriage is to be between one man and one woman. Neither is it lawful for any man to have more than one wife, nor for any woman to have more than one husband at the same time. Marriage was ordained for the mutual help of husband and wife, for the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue, and of the church with a holy seed, and for preventing of uncleanness. It is lawful for all sorts of people to marry who are able with judgment to give their consent, yet it is the duty of Christians to marry only in the Lord, and therefore such as profess the true Reformed religion should not marry with infidels, papists, or other idolaters. Neither should any such as are godly be unequally yoked by marrying with such as are notoriously wicked in their life or maintain damnable heresies. Well, the first thing that we see quite clearly is the institution of marriage as a monogamous institution. And I believe that that is clearly established by creation itself. And we read about that in Genesis chapter 2. Verse 18 and following. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable or answering to him." You might put it in the Hebrew. And then you read, "The Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place, and the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man, and brought her to the man. And the man said, 'This now is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman.'" In the Hebrew it's isha, because she was taken out of man, ish. "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." In commenting upon this in Matthew 19, which we were looking at just a moment ago, Jesus clearly says, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." And that's a slight difference, bringing out the fact that there are two and only two involved. The fact that throughout history, as far as we can tell, God, through His providence, has maintained the basic equality of the number of male and female persons on the earth is another sign of this being His intention. So I don't think we need to belabor that point. I might just, as an aside, also suggest that the creation account alone, in my opinion, forever precludes the legitimacy of something like homosexuality, because God, in making a helpmate suitable for man, made one woman. And those who argue that some people are just made that way, for them homosexual is normal, fly in the face of the creation ordinance of God, not to mention the specific legislation against it. Now, it is true that in the Old Testament period, polygamy did exist, and it existed among the patriarchs of the Old Testament. We're all aware of that fact, and it was tolerated by God. He did not require people like Jacob to put away one of their wives. And I believe that that is also reflected upon here by Jesus Christ when he says, "But from the beginning it was not so." In other words, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? The two shall be one flesh. Christ, in other words, is saying, in effect, that the creation ordinance of God already demonstrates that monogamy is the divine institution, and the fact that there were deviations from it in the lives of the patriarchs no more justify that than other deviations that we can find in their lives. Now, the Confession of Faith states that marriage has a manifold purpose. The first one mentioned is the mutual help of husband and wife, and that is clearly brought out in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where the sexual needs of man are clearly set down, and marriage is the institution in which they are to find fulfillment. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, and the word good there does not mean better. It just means good. Celibacy, the single life, is perfectly good. It's not better. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement, for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Clearly, then, the purpose of marriage, one purpose of marriage is sexual fulfillment. And it is a really striking thing that this is stated by the so-called Puritans that wrote the Westminster Confession of Faith as the number one purpose of marriage. Second to that is the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue. In other words, those are not identical. If you know anything about the history of Protestant Christianity as well as Roman Catholic, you'll know that the Victorian, so-called Victorian idea of sex as intrinsically evil has had its day, in which there have been those who have defended the idea that sex is legitimate only for the purpose of procreation. That was never the view of the Reformers. It was not the view of the writers of the Confession. It's not the biblical view. But, on the other hand, procreation is a purpose of marriage and may not be set aside. In recent years, whenever I've counseled young people to get married, I always go into that with them and get a very clear verbal commitment that they will have children, because you can't count on that anymore. People would rather work and sometimes not have a family, and I don't think that's biblical, because one of God's commandments is to be fruitful and multiply. That's not the only one, but that is one. And it is also, in God's plan, a principal means, maybe even the principal means, of perpetuating and building His church. For it is a fact of my experience that the vast majority of the living members of the Church of Jesus Christ that I've known were brought up in godly families. Most of you people sitting here, that's true of you. And if there is to be a church, it will be through the nurture of a holy seed. And there's a lot in the Bible about that. On the day of Pentecost, Peter said, "The promise is to you and to your children, even to those that are far off, as many as the Lord our God shall call." So we must emphasize the importance of this. We can understand today where nihilists, humanists, unbelievers who do not believe in a divinely controlled universe and do not believe in a divinely appointed destiny for the world and the human race, we can understand where they become frightened and decide to have no children, because they don't believe they can have any confidence in the future, and so they don't want to bring children into this sad world. But Christians cannot look at life that way. Christians are life-affirming, and they trust in the living God, and they believe because God is there, and because He has a covenant, and because He always is true to His covenant promise, that it is never futile to bring children into this world and nurture them in the Lord. It cannot be so, for He has promised that He will maintain His church through the line of the generations until Jesus comes. Section 3 is very relevant today because it says it is lawful for all sorts of people to marry. Now, I take that to mean that our confession recognizes marriage as a creation ordinance and therefore embracive of more than the Christian church. We as Christians want to see the ordinance of marriage maintained, in other words, not only in the church but in society. We should be very alarmed at the efforts today to destroy the family in the structure of society. One of the first things I became aware of in doing home missionary work in New England is how far the welfare state is really anti-family. I used to minister in housing projects in New England where a lot of women lived on aid to dependent children. Taxpayers' money, and they became virtually state-supported prostitutes, a lot of them. And they could make more money by not having a man in the house than by having him in the house. And so it was destructive of the family, and that's tragic. The laws of the land should be so designed as to encourage the stability of the family and to discourage people from living in neglect of it. I also believe that this does give even a Christian minister in certain instances a legitimate basis upon which to marry even unbelievers. I remember one time in Massachusetts when I was there in the OPC, two people came to me who were neither one of them Christians, and they asked me to marry them. And after considering all of the options, I did so as a person licensed by the state to do it, because I felt it was the line of least evil. Had I not done so, they probably would have started living together in a common law situation anyway. They were that determined. But under no circumstances can a Christian pastor marry one who is a Christian to one who is not. Now, the essential thing here is that the people be of the same faith. I'd like you now to look in a couple of places in the book of Exodus and Numbers. First, Exodus 2:16. What I am aiming at here is to show you that the nation of Israel never was racially exclusive. In Exodus 2:16, we read, "Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water. Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. They came to Reuel their father and said, and he said, 'Why have you come back so soon today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherd, and what's more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock.' He said to his daughters, 'Where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat.' And Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, 'I have been a sojourner in a foreign land.'" So Moses married someone who was not an Israelite by birth, and maybe even later married another woman, possibly after the death of the first. Numbers chapter 12, verse 1. "Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, 'Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses?'" Now, it's generally believed that this Cushite woman was of the Ethiopian race, because that's what the word Cushite means in biblical language. It probably means a woman who came from what we call the Sudan. If so, she was undoubtedly black and may have been part of the mixed multitude mentioned in Exodus chapter 12, verse 38. "And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds." This is well known and often commented on by the commentaries. Furthermore, we know that Joseph married an Egyptian woman from whom the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim were descended. On the other hand, please look at Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 4, and you will see how utterly opposed God was to any interreligious marriage. "When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you are entering to possess it, and shall clear away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, 7 nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them from before you, and you shall defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you." So, intermarriage across religious lines is absolutely forbidden. But far from being contrary to God's will to make inclusion of those from other nations. This is even provided for in Exodus 12. If you'd look in Exodus 12, in verses 48 and following, if a stranger sojourns with you and would celebrate the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near to celebrate it, and he shall be like a native of the land. Verse 49, the same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you. There is no evidence that I can find that any foreigner was excluded on the basis of race, ever. If he believed, submitted to the requirements of the law, was circumcised along with his male infant descendants, he was included in the nation of Israel. Maybe some of you have noticed in the news recently the black Jews coming to Israel. This goes way back to that sort of thing in their history. So, marriages were forbidden only on religious grounds. And if you look at one other, I think you'll see this quite clearly. Deuteronomy 21, verse 10. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also remove the clothes of her captivity, and shall remain in her house, in your house, and mourn her father and mother a full month, and after that you may go into her and be your husband, and she shall be your wife. So there is no question that intermarriage was permitted with races of all description, provided they came under the authority of Yahweh, the true and living God. Now, it's on the basis of that kind of material that our confession has stated that it is lawful for all sorts of people to marry, being the duty of Christians to marry only in the Lord. And therefore, the prohibited marriage for Reformed Christians are marriages with unbelievers. And since Roman Catholicism was looked upon by the Reformers as a false church, they were included, as were other idolaters, that is to say, people who were really so corrupted as to be no longer regarded as biblical Christians. The only thing you can say about Roman Catholicism in the 400 years since this was written is that their errors are now far greater than they were then. Please note that fact. While the Protestant world has softened its attitude toward Roman Catholicism, the fact is that within the last century and a half, the most monstrous errors of Rome have been officially promulgated. The perpetual virginity of Mary, the infallibility of the Pope, the bodily assumption of Mary, and the like. And I believe we must still take this stand, that people who are Roman Catholics must be regarded as corporately involved in that faith, that piety, that doctrine, that religion, and we should not look upon marriage between Reformed and Roman Catholic in a favorable light at all. Now, we go on to section 4, which reads as follows. Marriage ought not to be within the degrees of consanguinity or affinity, forbidden in the Word. Nor can such incestuous marriages ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. Then there is a section of the Westminster Confession at that point that has been deleted by the OPC, but was a part of the original formulation. And it reads as follows: the man may not marry any of his wife's kindred nearer in blood than he may of his own, nor the woman of her husband's kindred nearer in blood than of her own. The reason that has been eliminated is largely because, I think, of the pressure of existing cases. In one of my congregations in the old UP church, there was a man who had married the wife of the sister of his deceased wife. His wife died, and then he married the sister of that wife. That would be contrary to the original formulation of the Westminster Confession. In my humble judgment, the original formulation is correct, and we have made a needless concession in omitting it. But now let us look for a moment at the basis of this. The basis of it is found in Leviticus chapter 20. Verses 19 through 21. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, or of your father's sister, or such a one, for such a one has made naked his blood relative. They shall bear their guilt. If there is a man who lies with his uncle's wife, he has uncovered his uncle's nakedness. They shall bear their sin. They shall die childless. If there is a man who takes his brother's wife, it is abhorrent. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. Now, if I take my brother's wife, that means my brother dies. I take his wife. That's exactly analogous to a woman whose sister dies and she takes her sister's husband. They are perfectly analogous, so the one would exclude the other. That's the basis of it. The other is based on an analysis of chapter 18, and I'd like you to look at that for a moment, for a number of reasons, because it's a very important aspect of Scripture and one worth really looking at. If you look at chapter 18, beginning at verse 6, you have a whole list of close relatives with whom sexual union is forbidden. To uncover the nakedness of is a Old Testament Hebrew way of speaking of sexual union. None of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness. That's the general principle. I am the Lord. Then come what you would call the multiplied examples. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, meaning the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You are not to uncover her nakedness. And then it goes on with a whole list of them, and that list includes the following: your father's wife, your sister, your son's daughter, or your daughter's daughter, the daughter of your father's wife, meaning the daughter of a stepmother, and there's where affinity comes in, your father's sister, that is to say, an aunt, your mother's sister, also an aunt, your father's brother, an uncle, are his wife, your aunt, your daughter-in-law, or again, your brother's wife. Also forbidden is to be related to a woman and her daughter, or a son's daughter or a daughter's daughter, or a wife's sister. All of these are mentioned in that passage. Now, if you look for a moment at 1 Corinthians 5, you will see that Paul the Apostle clearly regarded this as binding. It is commonly reported that there is a more immorality among you, an immorality of such kind as does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. The thing that's interesting is this is a case of non-blood relationship. This woman, until she married your father, could be your wife. But no, she has married your father. Now, for some reason, your father's died or whatever, you can't marry her because she has been, possibly is, but I think has been, your father's wife. Now, what that establishes is that you work out these relationships over here by blood and over here by marriage, consanguinity and affinity, and all of the relationships that are forbidden by blood are also forbidden by marriage. For example, blood relative, my blood sister, but also my sister-in-law, forbidden. Again, a blood sister or a stepsister is forbidden. Wherever marriage comes into the picture, that marriage immediately locks into place the mirror image of the bloodline on this line over here, and both are forbidden. Now, I think I can understand that from a number of reasons, like psychologically. I've known my sister-in-law, Greta, Doris's sister, for so many years, I don't like to count them. And she is a sister to me. The thought of marrying her would be a violation of a family structure concept and idea and sensibility. It would not be right. I feel that without even the law to tell me. But the law also tells me that that is not right. It is evident from this case law back here in Leviticus that the family structure in Old Testament times was very much complicated also by polygamy. That's evident. You can see that. Because this father's wife and all that stuff comes in there so often on that basis. Nevertheless, it does show the exceeding great importance of the bond of marriage in biblical thought. And it also shows, in my opinion, that the law of Moses is taken for granted as valid and binding under the new covenant. And here is, for your thought, where I have some difficulty today in working out my own stand with regard to theonomy. The theonomy people, you've all heard about them, are people who are urging the church again to take a much more serious view of the perpetual binding character of the law of Moses. That doesn't mean they want to reintroduce the slaughter of bulls and goats or anything like that. But they believe for every law in the Old Testament there is a relevant and correct application under the New. And there are people that dismiss them as almost heretics. My problem with dismissing them is that on so many issues like this one right here, we all do the same thing. We argue that that law is valid and that you cannot marry your stepmother after your father's died. And the only basis we have for that is right there in the law of Moses. Well, how can those laws in Leviticus 18 all be relevant and binding, and other laws over in Leviticus 19 not be binding? That is the problem. I think really that when Christ said, "I didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it, to confirm it, and to uphold it," and so on, I think that he really binds us to some kind of theonomy, not the kind necessarily that's taught by R.J. Rushdoony or whoever, but some kind of theonomy, meaning the law of God is still binding. What we have to do is understand it and rightly apply it. Well, our confession understands this in a very straightforward way and says, in effect, these are still relevant and binding. These marriages, within the degrees of consanguinity, the bloodline or affinity, marriage line, are forbidden in the Word of God, and they cannot be made lawful. Now, finally we come in section 5 and 6 to the grounds upon which marriage may be annulled or set aside. Divorce, so on. Adultery or fornication committed after a contract being detected before marriage gives just occasion to the innocent party to dissolve the contract. That's like Joseph and Mary, he thought. In the case of adultery after marriage, it is lawful for the innocent party to sue out a divorce and after the divorce to marry another as if the offending party were dead. And then section 6 says, although the corruption of man is such as is apt to study arguments, unduly to put asunder those whom God has joined together in marriage, yet nothing but adultery, or such willful desertion as can no way be remedied by the church or civil magistrate, is cause sufficient for dissolving the bond of marriage, wherein a public and orderly course of proceedings is to be observed, and the persons concerned in it not left to their own wills and discretion in their own case. Now, the first instance there is like what you read in the case of Joseph and Mary. He thought she was guilty of fornication, sexual union with another man, although he was engaged to her, and so he was going to dissolve the contract to be married. But after marriage, our confession says two grounds, adultery or desertion. And because there's so much involved in that and our time is gone, I'm going to come back to that next week and try to deal at greater length, because I believe there is something more to be said than what the confession says about that. We'll leave it then at that point for tonight.